Yesterday we talked a little bit about the physical nature of gravitons and the issue of whether it's actually possible to detect single gravitons, and I reported results that people, conclusions that people have come to from kind of thought experiments, that it appears to be practically impossible to do that, at least in our own universe. I contrasted then a little bit what it means to quantize canonically, that means in terms of operators, finding spectra of self-adjoint operators, and of course primarily the Hamiltonian, versus covariant quantization, where you use path integrals and the primary dynamical objects you want to calculate are things like propagators and endpoint functions. I gave the example of, well, I briefly sketched what this looks like for the case of the non-relativistic particle, and emphasized that these two methods of solving the quantum system are entirely equivalent in principle, so you can get from one to the other, but in practice they may look sufficiently different to perhaps get you confused in the first place of that one is doing one and the same thing. The same two complementary possibilities exist in standard relativistic quantum field theory. And of course there we have additional features. We have of course infinitely many degrees of freedom, but often it's convenient to work in a formalism that is explicitly, manifestly Lorentz invariant, Poincaré invariant. And this is what the path integral does for you in a way. You can also canonically quantize field theories. There's no problem in principle. And you might do that, for example, when you're interested in exhibiting manifest unitarity of the theory. But something like Lorentz, I mean, action under the Lorentz group looks, issues like connected to this look more complicated. So one could say, actually, the choice is maybe there one of convenience, depending on the context and the questions you ask. Now, the same arguments go through in a straightforward way to perturbative quantum gravity, which we just treat like an ordinary field theory on Minkowski space. But more than that, actually, they also carry over these two possibilities. You also have when you non-perturbatively quantize the theory. Of course, you no longer have Poincaré symmetry present, but instead you have another group acting. You have the full group of four-dimensional diffeomorphisms acting, and quite a similar thing happens depending on whether you quantize covariantly or you quantize canonically. So when you quantize covariantly, you will still have this symmetry, this full symmetry group floating around. When you quantize canonically, what you have to do, you have to kind of settle on an arbitrary choice of time. So you have like a 3 plus 1 decomposition, and you kind of, you watch your degrees of freedom, your configuration variables and conjugate momenta as a function of that time. And the operators, they're typically, they just live on these surfaces of constant time. What this also implies is that the way, well, the form the four-dimensional diffeomorphism group takes, or its associated algebra, is actually different. So what you find there, for instance, if you just, let me not talk about the full group, but let me just look at the algebra. Of course, when I'm in the covariant context, I still have an infinite-dimensional Lie algebra associated with the infinite-dimensional group of diffeomorphisms. But when I come to this 3 plus 1 way of writing it, when I want to do quantize canonically, then I find a kind of projected version of this algebra. You get to that, I'll mention that later on in the course, this is the so-called Dirac algebra. And the generators of that algebra are the quantum constraints of the theory. But it's no longer the same algebra. So it knows already about this 3 plus 1 splitting you've done. So things generally look then, again, rather different from what they look like in the covariant picture. I ended by writing down kind of a formal gravitational path integral for you without making any specification of whether that was perturbative or non-perturbative. It's just a general expression. So I was asked afterwards, what was this notation I introduced? G of m was the kind of four-dimensional differential manifold I chose in the first place, on which the dynamics takes place. And this curly G denotes geometries, by which I mean equivalence classes of Lorentzian metrics. These are the G mu nu's, modulo the action of the diffeomorphism group. So it just means it's a kind of a equivalence class notation. I identify two of these Lorentzian metrics whenever I can get from one to the other by a four-dimensional diffeomorphism. Okay, and then my integration here, my functional integration, goes over exactly those equivalence classes indicated by the square bracket e to the I gravitational action of g mu nu. The way I've written it now is I've suppressed the dependence on the boundary conditions. Often they are not written, and you have to kind of understand what is implied. Sometimes this is an important question. I've just exhibited here the dependence on the coupling constants of the theory. Of course, they appear here in the form of the action. So what I'm here considering here is just simple, I mean, the Einstein-Hilbert action, which has a curvature term, and the inverse Newton constant multiplies that overall, and this is the lambda, this is a cosmological term, which you usually also consider, depending on the context. What we'll do next, we really look at what becomes of this in the context of the perturbative quantum field theory, where I make this split of g mu nu equal to eta mu nu plus linear perturbation. So this is about the perturbative path integral for gravity. Well, that's still an important subject in a way. Of course, we'll see what its shortcomings are also. But it's important to understand what's going wrong in order to then move on and perhaps try something different. So the idea is the same as with other perturbative field theories. You split up the action into a piece that is merely quadratic in the fundamental dynamical fields, plus interaction terms which can be of higher order than quadratic. And what you then do, kind of you make a systematic expansion. I mean, typically, I mean, this interaction is characterized by one or more coupling constants, so that that specify kind of the interaction strength. And then you do a systematic expansion in powers of that coupling constant, and at each order, you pick up a bunch of terms. Say, if you want to compute amplitudes or propagators, and these have the usual kind of graphic representation in terms of Feynman graphs. So that's kind of the whole. This unleashes this whole formalism, where you then have these Feynman rules that associate with specific, I mean, algebraic pieces here of an expansion, of a power expansion, certain graphic elements. And of course, you can also just do it the other way around if you're interested. The power of that is if you're interested in computing for a certain process, what are the contributions at a certain order in your perturbation theories, then it suffices kind of to write down all the Feynman diagrams, you know, use the Feynman rules, perhaps work out some symmetry factors, and then you can just start computing. So here, this enables us to compute arbitrary amplitudes, order by order in perturbation theory. And what this looks like for simple examples like, you know, scalar field or fermionic fields or gauge electric magnetism, you should have learned elsewhere. So I'm referring to this. Well, I already hinted that there are various questions one can ask about applying this to gravity. Kind of following up on the discussion of, you know, how real are gravitons, of course, kind of the typical things one computes here are scattering amplitudes. And here, well, the natural thing if I do this for gravity would be to say, oh, let me calculate scattering amplitudes for gravitons. Perhaps, after all we've said, well, these are not the most kind of physically interesting things to compute because they, well, it may be difficult to relate them to kind of actual observables that might have a chance of being computed. So there is certainly an issue of how useful a formalism is this. Now, there is, however, an even stronger objection you could have against this if you're really interested in finding a theory of quantum gravity that is valid on all scales. Now, the problem here is it doesn't seem to be the case that you can do it in a perturbative manner. I'll comment on this a little more in the course of this lecture, but it appears that this perturbation series you get here is too divergent for us to make any sense out of it with standard regularization and renormalization techniques. What do these techniques entail? They entail trying to extract meaningful finite numbers from especially the higher orders in perturbation theory that tend, well, to diverge if you compute them just naively. And for some interesting theories, you can do that in a systematic way, and these are the renormalizable theories, but there are others, gravity being an example of them, for which this breaks down. It simply doesn't make sense. Keeping this in mind, let me just flash the kind of expressions that appear here and kind of explain to you where they come from and what they're good for. So to start with, one usually sets lambda equal to zero. If the cosmological constant would not be zero, then Minkowski space would not actually be a solution. So then it doesn't make much sense to split up G mu nu into Minkowski metric plus a little perturbation because the eta mu nu itself is not a solution. So this is my usual starting point for perturbative gravity. My action, so the classical, the piece of this action that survives, therefore in explicit terms is given by four-dimensional integral square root of the modulus of the determinant of the metric G mu nu times the Ricci scalar. And you remember that is an object, again, that depends on, of course, G and the first and second derivatives of G. And we stick in our perturbative ansatz and expand this in powers of F mu nu. Our linearized amplitudes. Now, just schematically, what kind of terms does that give rise to, say, coming from this Ricci scalar? Schematically, well, everything is quadratic in curvature, so kind of the lowest order term in the F, so it's simply be a term kind of with two F derivatives, then go to higher powers, I get, well, some F del F del F plus F squared del F del F, possibly after making kind of partial integrations. Yeah, so I have these linear terms standing here. So that's clearly, well, that's what one expects. Now, in order to absorb this prefactor, so that's the first term in my action is simply a kind of a quadratic term in derivatives, one usually redefine f mu by constant factor to get some f mu tilde, 1 divided by square root of 16 pi gn f mu. It's just a convenience to exhibit also the kind of the functional dependence in this higher order term on this coupling constant. Yeah, so this is, of course, kind of the effective coupling constant here. Gn is a Newton's coupling constant. And writing things in the same kind of schematic way, now in terms of these F tilde variables, F tilde del F tilde plus, and then I get kind of first square root factor, 16 pi gn at the next order, F tilde del F tilde plus same square root 16 pi gn F tilde all squared del F tilde plus higher order terms. And of course, well, this is my quadratic piece, obviously, in F, and all the rest here kind of is the interaction part of the action, or the Lagrange. Here we are talking about the integrand, so of the Lagrange density. So this is L interact, I call this. Of course, what I've suppressed here in writing it schematically is kind of index structure. So at each order, of course, you get various ways of contracting these indices. Now, so apart from the somewhat more complex index structure, this has just kind of the familiar form, if you like. If you compare it to something like, you know, a scalar field theory, you have this lowest order term, which is a quadratic in the fields, and then you have higher order stuff, and here kind of the effective coupling is like the square root of gn and higher powers of that. So in principle, you know, you just start grinding away with your formalism. So the coupling constant, as it appears there, is clearly the square root of gn. And now in natural units, where we set h bar and c, the speed of light, to zero, this is can be seen to be proportional to the inverse Planck mass. And I forget now whether that was one of the things you were asked to compute on the first problem sheet. So this just, well, one often works when one now makes arguments about the dimensionality of certain terms, one works either in units of length or in units of mass, which are inverse to each other kind of inertial units. So here one says, square root of Gn has, it's like 1 over mass, or what one also says is Gn itself has squared inverse mass dimension, so negative mass dimension. Yeah?
So this is going back to, in your last question, what contracts on what?
Sorry, you can't see what?
Just the notation, what contracts on what in that equation?
Oh, sorry, so this is one. Well, I'm grouping together the F tilde factors without the derivatives with factors of square root of Gn. So this, have I drawn some brackets? No, I think that's all right. So, like this? Does this help?
Yeah.
Oh, like the indices I suppressed here? Well, all possible combinations will occur, essentially. So each of these, of course, has, you know, three indices here on the del, on the derivative and on the F2. And this will have two indices. And there are, of course, yeah, various ways of contracting these with eta mu nu. Yeah. So here, this is our coupling constant. And of course, well, this is a large mass scale compared to what you find in other interactions. So this is a small coupling constant, this square root of Gn. Let's see. Did I want to see? Natural units. Another thing to note is, because this term, well, first of all, because of this piece here, and also because of inverse occurrences of the metric G mu nu, so G mu nu with indices upstairs is usually written, this expansion doesn't break off after a finite number of terms, so you get infinitely many terms in this expansion. Infinitely. Many terms. Okay, now let me. So, of course, the next thing you usually do, you know, when you establish the Feynman rules, the next thing you do is you find out what the propagator of the theory is. And please recall how you do this. You write this in a form where it, this quadratic piece, where it's field, some differential operator, field, and then this differential operator is the inverse. You have to invert it to get the propagator of the theory. So let us see how this plays out here. So that then would give us the graviton propagator. And just to remind you of an easier analogy, motivate what we do, if you look at a QED, just the action for, well, let's just look at the gauge field part, the pure gauge field part of that without any fermions coupled. Then this has the following form, F mu nu, I hope you recall. And these Fs, of course, they are F mu nu is del mu a nu minus del mu a mu in terms of the gauge potential a mu. Right? So they are both linear in A, And what you do by a partial integration is to bring it into exactly this form I just mentioned. You write it as field something, some differential operator, mu nu, in order for this to have all the indices contracted, times another field. Okay. And this thing then, well, this is some differential operator, and it's the inverse of the propagator. So if I want to know what the propagator is, I have to invert this. There was a question here? Yeah?
This is going back here.
Yeah.
The expression has an infinite number of terms.
Yeah.
But the coupling has mass dimension minus one. So I was wondering, why can't we just flesh out irrelevant operators?
Why can't we what?
Why can't we just ignore irrelevant operators? So, like irrelevant in terms of dimension.
Well, we are writing this is, at the moment, this is completely classical. I haven't yet said anything of how I'm going to, what role these things play in the quantum theory. But what I will be analyzing is, of course, how these higher order contributions will contribute, possibly, as function of the momenta, how they will be divergent, just by their dimensional analysis. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. We'll see what happens there. So we have already, have we? I don't know. I say I don't know because I don't think you have, because it was one of the problems of last year, which we didn't let you do this year, is to write down the Lagrangian in terms of the linearized fields. They have done that? That is a homework problem. Good. Okay then, right. So this is what it is, says Dennis. All right. Okay. So now, of course, I will put in all the indices, and you get all the terms here. Del lambda f mu nu minus 1/2 del lambda f mu mu del lambda f mu nu minus del lambda f mu nu del mu f lambda nu, and there's a fourth term, plus del lambda f lambda mu del mu f nu nu. So you see that even at lowest order, it's a lot of fun to work out these coefficients and not make zillions of mistakes. Now, what you want to do is, again, to bring it into such a form by doing partial integrations in the integrand of the action. So, of course, appropriately taking care of boundary terms, you will then be able to put it into a form f rho sigma something m rho sigma mu nu f mu nu. Okay, so of course in terms of index structure, this is one level up from the electromagnetic gauge field, which has only a single index. Here our f is of course a two tensor, and therefore also this object has to be of higher order. Yeah. No, with the Minkowski metric. Yeah. Because at this order, you see, you are only asked to keep terms that are quadratic in F. And if I raise and lower with a full metric, I would pick another factor of F, so it would be actually a term of higher order. So at this order, this is how it goes. Now, if you now look at this M, what this M is, and you try to invert it, you'll meet the same sort of obstacle you already met when you tried to do this for the photon field. And why? Well, it turns out that simply this object is not invertible. In the same way as this object, mu nu, wasn't invertible. Namely, for example, it has a zero vector, so if you multiply that into a four momentum k, in a Fourier transform k, then this is zero. So it has zero eigenvectors, this thing. And the same holds true for this object. And it is, again, ultimately a consequence of gauge invariance, of part of your degrees of freedom being gauge and not strictly physical. So unfortunately, therefore, we have to think of something to fix this. M is not invertible, has zero modes, just like in QED. Well, and since we have already dealt with this in QED, fortunately, a very similar recipe of how to fix this also goes through in gravity. Do I still need this, perhaps? So something I will not force you to show, but is actually quite straightforward if you have some spare time for doing a calculation, is the following. I get to you in a sec. So what does one do? One adds a suitable term to the action that I had started erasing here. A so-called gauge-fixing term, which will make that this M, this capital M with the four indices, will become invertible. And it mirrors a kind of a trick, the same kind of trick I can also perform in QED. So I certainly hope you've seen that in that other context. So let me just state what you do and what the result is. So by adding a so-called gauge-fixing term, F, curly F mu, index upstairs, index downstairs, to L, did I call this LFP? I wanted to call it something. Oh, yeah, I've called it LFP. Why do I call it LFP? I'm not sure. I mean, FP suggests Fadeev-Popov, but why should I call this Fadeev-Popov? Well, what I have in mind is Lenoir's gravity. What could FP stand? What could I have had in mind by this? Okay, never mind. To LFP, first. Yeah, I'm not sure. Okay, that's linearized gravity to LFP. Now I have to tell you what this term curly F is. F mu, of course it depends on the Fs, is an expression you've seen before. Del nu F mu nu minus 1/2 del mu f new. Remember, that is what the harmonic gauge, setting this to zero, was the so-called harmonic gauge. And the claim is that then the differential operator becomes, the differential operator is this thing here, becomes M tilde rho sigma mu nu equal to minus eta rho mu eta sigma nu Minkowski metric plus 1/2 eta rho sigma eta mu nu del squared which is invertible. Of course, it's what you usually do is now you look at what this looks like in the Fourier transform, then these will become K dependencies, and then it's just an algebraic thing to work out what the inverse is, that it has an inverse, and what the inverse is, and that is, of course, an the propagator in this particular gauge. And the construction is completely analogous to what you do in a QED, where the role of this F is played by del mu A mu. So if you put that in squared into the gauge field action, then it has exactly the same effect. Now, that is that. So that's actually, well, not quite the full a story. But one has to, well, when there's some kind of additional things one has to pay attention to in gravity. So actually a proper way of doing that gauge fixing and also making sure that after you've put in these extra terms that the theory is still unitary is that, well, one has to put yet another term into the action, and now we get to the FP. So that's really following the method by Fadeev and Popov. So what you do is, in a clever way, you insert into the full path integral, you insert, well, a suitable decomposition of unity. So what does that mean? So you insert one into the full path integral, into the path integral. And divide out by a factor which is infinite, but which is the volume of the gauge group. So here, this would be the linearized diffeomorphisms. So what is this? What is the one you are inserting? It consists of various pieces. This notation delta curly F. F. This is a so-called Fadeev Popov determinant. And what else you get is del G. Well, this is now not the G mu nu. That is kind of an integral over the gauge group. So this stands for, let me call it some other thing, G, not to get confused. So these are kind of the gauge, a formal way of writing the gauge group parameters. Gauge group times product over mu, the delta function of f mu of f. So what do these various things correspond to? So that is the delta function that implements for all components mu the harmonic gauge. The harmonic gauge is just f mu equal to 0. Okay, so it means I'm inserting a delta function and I'm forcing the system to sit on the subspace of the big configuration space where this is satisfied. At the same time, well, of course, I have forgotten then about, you know, the directions in the group direction, and they are presented here in a somewhat formal way. And what it turns out I also have to take care of, and that's kind of geometrically where this term comes from, in order to make the split between kind of the gauge degrees of freedom along the gauge orbits and kind of the degrees of freedom that lie along the so-called constraint surface defined by the simultaneous vanishing of all of these f curly f mu's. In order, I have to go kind of to adapted coordinates, you know, where just then part goes along the gauge fibers and part goes along the physical directions. And this here turns out to be the Jacobian associated with this coordinate transformation. Of course, the coordinate transformation on field space. So I start out, you know, with all my fields, and then I split them up into gauge directions and directions along this physical constraint surface, and the associated Jacobian is here. And it turns out, in order to maintain unitarity, and that was really the insight of these people, one actually has to keep this term. It is also clear that it all depends on the type of gauge condition one has. So this is why this has this index curly f here. So that appears here. So this is kind of necessary. Sorry, this was what I had before. So it's needed in gravity. Gravity for unitarity. So this particular insight was not actually due to Fadeev Popov. That was already known earlier to Feynman and de Witt. But kind of this general, to set up this general formalism was done by these people. If you're interested in understanding more of this, I lectured on this for an hour in last year's QG course. I'm leaving it out this time around because it's a little bit tangential to what I'm doing. So it's definitely important, you know, it pops up everywhere, of course, in gauge field theories also. But I'm not teaching it this year because I want to cover some more of the, you know, core quantum gravity stuff towards the end of the course. Yeah, so it's important to understand this. I also went through in this lecture an explicit finite dimensional kind of toy example where one tries to understand, yeah, what for a finite dimensional, you know, baby system, where these various terms come from and, you know, the role they play and the geometric interpretation they have. Okay. Now, in order to wrap up the chapter on perturbative gravity, let me just throw some of the expressions at you Well, let me just show what the propagator looks like, so that it's part of the Feynman rules, and let me give you an idea of what other elements of the Feynman rules, what kind of algebraic expressions they are associated with. So here comes, so this is the propagator in harmonic gauge. And in the Feynman diagrams, traditionally, the Graviton propagator is associated with a wiggly line. So this is what it is. Associated with momentum k. But of course, now it has a non-trivial index structure because of the nature of the field. So on either end of this wiggly line, I have a pair of open indices, mu1, mu1, mu2, mu2. And associated with this element of my Feynman diagram is just the expression for the propagator d mu1 mu2 semicolon mu2 of k is given by 1/2 eta mu1 mu2 eta mu1 u2 plus eta mu1, mu2, eta, mu1, mu2, minus eta, mu1, mu1, eta, mu2, mu2, with a standard denominator, k squared, minus I epsilon. So that's the standard I epsilon prescription, and if you're wondering about it, well, the relative sign, of course, remember that we're using the opposite convention for the scalar products, opposite sign convention for the Minkowski scalar products. So k is just the momentum associated with that line in a momentum space Feynman diagram. But of course, what I also have are now the pieces where the interactions come in, right? So the next thing, this is my, at next order, what I find at next order is this cubic term in the Fs. Now what, so it has two derivatives of the Fs, and the F itself. Now, you see, what is peculiar about this, well, compared, say, if I do a lambda phi cube scalar field theory, is that derivatives appear here. Yes? I mean, usually you'd have just, you know, cubic, an expression that's cubic in the fields, but not with, with derivatives, in kind of simple interaction terms. So here, derivatives come into play, and of course, in a momentum space picture, they will translate into powers of k. So what we find, therefore, here now are, if I look at the piece, I mean, the kind of the threefold kind of intersection that's associated for the Feynman diagrams with this term, it will actually, it's algebraic, it will be associated with an algebraic expression that is quadratic in k. And that's important because the k's contribute to the momentum integrals which I have to perform in order to evaluate the Feynman diagram. So the next thing, of course, the next element here I have to consider is this intersection of three graviton lines associated with three momenta k1, K2, K3, and lots of indices, mu two down here is mu one up here is mu three. So this is kind of the three graviton vertex in harmonic gauge. Now, can you still see this? Let me just write this down. Let me start writing it down. Maybe it's better to go to this paper. So let me call this curly V. Of course, it has now an even more complicated index structure, three pairs, nu one, mu three, and it depends on the three momenta, K1, K2, K3. Okay, let's get started. That is a K1 dot K2, so these are Minkowski scalar products, eta mu one, eta mu two, eta mu three, plus K1 mu3, K2 mu3, eta mu1, mu2, eta mu1, mu2. Now, I'm not going to write the full thing down because it turns out to have more than 100 terms. Plus many others. Actually, there's so many. I haven't found this in any book. I looked there. But when you go back to the original calculation by Bryce DeWitt, you find it in some, fifth ref paper back from the 1967. And it fills, half a page. And this is just the lowest order, threefold vertex. Of course, there are many higher order vertices, right? You can see that life starts getting a little lengthy here with the computation of even the simplest Feynman diagram, a one loop diagram or something. So talking about loop diagrams, of course, already, say, in scalar field theory, of course, that once you go beyond just tree diagrams, immediately the contributions you compute from your Feynman rules, which then involve momentum integrals over the internal loops, start diverging as a function of the momenta and having... what makes them diverge is the contributions in the ultraviolet, so for very high values of the momenta. Okay. And the very same thing happens here. Of course, if you're lucky, as I said before, you can kind of get rid of these infinities in a systematic way by reabsorbing them into redefinitions of the original coupling constant, the original constants you put in the bare action, in the bare Lagrangian to start with. Unfortunately, this is not the case for gravity. So the question of whether this is true for gravity would be to say, well, is this theory of perturbative gravity, is it actually perturbatively renormalizable? And I was already anticipating the answer. Unfortunately, it's no. So let me just sketch that in the last 5 minutes we have here. So what is the kind of simple dimensional? So the answer is no. Well, so let's make a dimensional analysis. So well, my coupling was given essentially in terms of G Newton. And we have already seen that this has squared inverse mass dimensions. Also sometimes written in this way, Gn is minus 2, if you're counting the mass dimensions. Now, of course, what you do in order to control these divergences that appear for the loop diagrams, one thing you can do is just to introduce a cutoff on the momenta for high momenta. So you ignore the very high momenta. You put say, a Lorentz invariant momentum cutoff. And we call this lambda. And then what you find kind of on arbitrary amplitude, m, if you now look what are the contributions to lowest order, to first order in the coupling Gn, to second order, then typically what you find is something of the following structure, so that is a kind of the lowest order contribution. Then you get correction pieces at order Gn, at order Gn squared. But of course, and once you've done the momentum integration, of course, the only kind of three-dimensional parameter that's here is this lambda. So lambda is, of course, again, of dimension of mass, energy momentum. So, and this was, had inverse squared mass dimension. So, and of course, this whole thing here in the brackets is just a dimensionless number. So it's clear that the lambda dependence must appear in this way. Lambda squared, lambda fourth, whatever else is there. So this is just clearly, this is the lambda dependence as it must appear in these higher order terms. Now, why is that bad? It's bad if you're interested in letting lambda go to infinity, namely remove this cutoff, because you see, you get very bad divergences in powers of lambda, this infinite momentum scale in that case. Yeah, so that makes this just extremely ill-defined and in a way that cannot be absorbed systematically by redefining a coupling constant. And you see really the reason for why this happens from the simple dimensional argument has to do with the nature of the coupling constant, the dimension, the dimensionality, the mass dimension of the coupling constant. So that's the dimensional argument. So, and you also see that at higher and higher orders, so where you have more and more kind of higher loops contributing to your amplitudes, the divergences get worse, worse and worse and worse at each order. Okay, so that does mean, formally, this appears to be non-renormalizable perturbatively. Of course, what could happen is that, you know, at each order, many, many terms contribute. Many is, you know, is an understatement. I mean, if you have a single diagram, say with two threefold intersections, you already have 100 times 100 terms from there. Each insertion here gives you another factor of three because you have three pieces there, and you can see this is completely overwhelming, even with beyond second loop, say. No one has even dared kind of tackling this type of computation. Yeah. But, of course, you could be lucky in principle that whatever multiplies this, I mean, the diagrams, their contribution adds up to zero because of some magic. But usually there's no magic involved. When this happens, there is usually a good reason, I mean, a specific symmetry. Yeah. So that could still happen. That's what people try to establish by explicit computation. And what they found actually very nicely is that if you just look at pure gravity without any matter coupling, it is finite, so these terms cancel at one loop. So it's one loop finite on shell. What does that mean? When making use of the equations of motion. That's a famous result by Toft and Feldman, 1972. Unfortunately, this is no longer, so what one uses here, the cancellations that happen are due, first of all, to using the equations of motion, secondly, to an identity that exists between second-order curvature terms, the so-called Gauss-Bonnet identity. But unfortunately, this is like more like accidentally to happen. And, well, if you couple matter to it, already at one loop, the finiteness is spoiled. So there are no magic cancellations happen, and you get a divergence. Also, if you stick with pure gravity at two loop, this result doesn't hold anymore. So also there, you pick up an infinity. So that's another result of an explicit computation, a horrendous computation, one should say, at two loops. Of course, one doesn't do these things by hand, but even of, you know, just evaluating them, you know, say with a computer, is a big challenge. 1986, and that was independently confirmed by Van der Ven in 1992, and had been strongly suspected all along. This closes the door to making this perturbative approach useful as a definition or a tool to understand gravity on arbitrarily high scales. If for some reason you're only interested in a situation up to a certain energy scale, you may be able to justify having a specific lambda in here and then just computing perturbative corrections to whatever quantity you're interested in. And that's something that people have done, that one calls that an effective field theory computation. Effective field theory means I use this as a kind of a computational tool, and I know it won't be valid for arbitrary high energies, but if I'm very lucky, there might be some interesting observables I can compute where I have a good reason for keeping lambda finite. Yeah. And then, well, this is hopefully a viable tool for doing the computation. Okay, so that finishes our discussion of perturbative quantum gravity. What we'll do next week is canonical quantization. Yeah, so small question?
Yeah.
No, that is just my terrible handwriting. It's from 1992. Okay, have a good weekend.